This is Sarah Nayani. I am the host of this little podcast here. And I find that this intro always sounds better when I dance a little bit while I record it. So I hope you guys are too. That little intro music's got a little pep to its step. I am deliriously tired today, and that might come through while I'm recording. So just FYI. I did the florals for a big wedding for my friend Erin yesterday. It was amazing. It was wonderful. But I am tired with a capital T today. And part of the reason I wanted to make this podcast was to kind of document what's going on with my small business and meet other people who have businesses like this. So I got to keep it real on the pod and just talk about the realities of growing flowers and selling flowers. It is hard work. It is intense. And especially for doing something like a wedding, it's a lot of pressure. I definitely felt that pressure, especially because it was for my friend that I was doing the florals, and I just wanted her to be so over the top happy on her gorgeous big day. I didn't want to mess anything up, and you know, the florals show up in a lot of photos, so they're going to be with her for a while. So I just wanted it to be perfect, and I think as I was designing in my kitchen in the middle of the night, I just would have these like, you know, kind of like moments of panic of, wow, this is a big day for someone. And if I mess this up or they don't like the florals that I create, that's a big deal. I want them to like them. And I think that pressure is really bad for designing. So I had to take a step back, take a little bit of an edible, let's be honest, listen to some good music and just like try to relax. And then it came a lot more naturally. But unfortunately, it just took me a little bit to get into that mindset. And so I was up pretty late, let's just say, for two nights in a row. And so I'm a little bit out of it today. I have to say, though, I'm really proud with how it turned out. And it was so fun to work with my friend who just has amazing taste and style. She was the most beautiful bride. And what I loved is that she had an idea to go with a spring goth vibe. So she wanted a lot of whites and then some black flowers in there too. So like dark, dark purple tulips. We did like the snake's head fritillaria with the checkered pattern. It's really cool because her dad assigned each of his three daughters and his wife a specific flower. And so she is the daffodil, and then her two sisters are the iris and the poppy, and her mom is a tulip. And I just thought that was so cool and meaningful that her family has these special associations with flowers. So we included all of those in her bouquets and arrangements. And then also they're Scottish, so thistle is a really important symbol for them. So I did all of the boutonnieres and corsages with thistle, and then to soften it up, I did a little bit of the like dried bunny tail. And I also used some white ranunculus in the corsages. I didn't realize how long ranunculus can last out of water. I did make the corsages the night before, so they weren't out of water long, but I tested it out last week and the week before. I cut some ranunculus stems and I put them just like on the table in my kitchen, and I just let them sit there and see how long they would last. And some of them lasted for like 3 to 4 days and looked fine. So, and I don't have a floral fridge or cooler yet. They're really expensive. I have a really small house and we don't really have anywhere to put it. I guess we could put something in the backyard, but I just haven't gotten to that stage yet. So I do most of my designing like in this really crunch, pressure-filled time where I try to get everything out of the way that I can, like organizing the schedule, you know, making a packing list so I don't forget anything, like laying out my outfit the night before and trying to make sure that I have like all the equipment and things that I might need when I'm on site, and then other things that, you know, just for backup that I might need. Like if a vase broke, I try to bring an extra vase or, you know, extra chicken wire, things like that that you just might need. And they usually come in handy because even if you don't use them, other vendors or like wedding guests or, you know, groomsmen or whoever like might end up needing something. So that's kind of cool. I try to do that all in advance before an event, but there's usually a 48-hour crunch time for me. Like this wedding was on a Saturday, and so I picked up flowers at the wholesale market on a Thursday and did my harvesting for the wedding on a Thursday. And it's tough because you want to time it out so that everything opens beautifully for the wedding and is like at its prime at the wedding. And so you have to kind of know like each flower and what stage it's at on that Thursday and will it be like open and ready to go on the Saturday. And you also have to do, if you're doing it that way, you have to do a little bit of the design work in preparation for some of those flowers to open. Like I find tulips a little bit difficult to work with because they tend to go like straight up in the air. Like you make the design and it's this beautiful flowing curve on the edge of the tulip that's going over the side of the vase and you leave it overnight and then the next morning you wake up and it's like stiff, straight as an arrow, like standing straight up and it's no longer in the place that it was in last night. They move around and you know, it's not that swirly thing anymore. So I find that like I try to make all the arrangements and then the next morning I have to do a lot of editing. I think that's probably pretty normal to do several rounds of editing. Like I try to edit while I'm designing, after I finish the design, the morning after I like give it a swirl on my little turntable flower tool that I have and just like check for major holes that I missed or anything like that, things that have moved overnight. Then I pack it up in the van. For this wedding, I actually rented a U-Haul because all the order that she had wouldn't fit in my car. So I was like, we're doing it big. We're going to get a rental. And then I edit like as I'm putting them onto the table and then do like a final walkthrough before I leave the setup. I actually don't know if that's normal or not. I didn't have any formal training. I mean, I took a bunch of like online classes and a couple in-person classes, read a bunch of books. I just obsessively look at photos of flower arrangements. And so I am by no means an expert and I think I might be going a little crazy, like driving myself crazy with some of this stuff because I think I could probably take a little bit more of a chill pill, but I think it's sort of that like imposter syndrome of just feeling like, well, why would someone want the flowers that I'm creating? And just feeling scared that, you know, what I've made isn't good enough or that I need to add more, make it bigger. I don't know. It's just, I want to be honest about how I'm feeling when I do this because I want to connect with other people that are doing this too. And like, maybe other people feel that way. I don't know. So yeah, I guess I would just say that I'm really honored and happy that I got to design for that wedding. I just love when people are drawn to flowers and have a special connection with certain flowers. I really try to include that in what I'm designing for them and create something that's like meaningful beyond just, oh, this is beautiful, but is like actually connected to your family or your story in some way. So it was wonderful to work on this wedding and design with flowers that were really meaningful to this family. And I had so much fun because I hired my friend Megan to help me on the day of with the setup. So it was so cool to have like a good friend there with me. She's one of my best friends and we just like work really well together. And so I picked her up on the morning of. We drove up together. She helps me not be delirious. We drank a lot of coffee. We set up the wedding. She did all of the bud vases with a lot of the flowers that I have grown and some extras that I had from designing. And then she also like helped me tie all the ribbons onto the bride's bouquet and the 8 bridesmaids' bouquets. And then, you know, we did like the walkthrough together. She just was amazing. It was really fun to work with her and just have someone like that by your side while you're doing this. And then we were also attending the wedding. It was such a fun wedding, but we decided to go get a hotel room to like change and do our makeup because we didn't want to be in the way of like the wedding party. And so we got a hotel room for 45 minutes. It was so funny. We like went to get lunch and we didn't realize what time it was. And so by the time we like rolled up to the hotel, we had to leave like 40 minutes later for the wedding. So I did like a quick body shower because it's a lot of heavy lifting, like setting up a wedding. It's like flower buckets and, you know, you load up the van and then you unload when you get there. And I had packed like card tables and, you know, just super big buckets of flowers to design and like set up. I did a little floral installation by the sweetheart table that they had. So I just brought, you know, these big buckets of tall flowers. So anyway, it was really fun to have Megan there. And it was just funny that we like did a really quick kind of sketchy hotel stay for a minute. And then, yeah, I came back last night. And then today is Sunday that I'm recording this. And it was just a really lazy day. I watched a lot of Real Housewives and just kind of took the day off except for making this podcast. So it was nice to just relax a little bit. One thing that really helped me get through this week is I found this podcast called Dish the Dirt. It's an Australian podcast. This woman, Rebecca, her business is called Little Lady Plume, started this podcast, Dish the Dirt. And I started from episode one, so I'm like listening through. And so I'm on season two, but I don't know. She might have changed the format since where I'm listening from. But at least at the beginning of her show, she was going around Australia and interviewing flower farmers around the region. She's like a florist and she sources her flowers from flower farmers. And it's just really cool to hear all of these people's stories, how they got into it, what they do, what their businesses look like. Not to mention their Australian accents are amazing. It's just really cute. It made me happy. And so I just wanted to recommend that if people want to listen. And I actually direct messaged Rebecca and I asked her if she would be on my next season of Flower Friends. So she wrote back and said she would love to. So I hope we can find a time to connect. I know she's a mom. She's got little ones. So we'll see if we can get her on for the next season. But basically what I'm planning to do with Flower Friends is I recorded a bunch of interviews for season one. So I kind of have my guests like set for season one. But if people have ideas for who I could interview for my next season, I would love to hear from you who you want to hear from. So I know most of the episodes I've done so far have been focused more on the growing side. We had Hillary from Seattle Urban Farm Co. on, and we talked about creating raised beds and a bunch of other growing topics. We had Jay from Jay's Garden Journal on, and we talked about sheet mulching and the benefits of that and creating a beautiful garden space. We've talked to Margaret from Ballard Urban Flowers about seed starting and getting really healthy plants in the ground. And on this episode today, we're going to hear from Margaret again. It's kind of part two. We did seed starting on the first one, and today we're going to talk dahlias. So I know all of these topics so far have been about growing, but we do have some florists coming on to this season. So after Margaret's episode today on dahlias, next week it's going to be a conversation with Paula from Paisley Petals. She's an amazing florist. She actually did mine and my husband Vikram's wedding flowers, and that's how I met her. And I've been following along with her ever since. She's incredible and just so lovely. She's such a lovely person, and she has so much great information about like how to select a wedding florist and just tips about like pricing and kind of like knowing your worth. And I don't know, it was incredible to talk to her. So that's coming up next. And later in the season, we are also going to get to hear from Alyssa from Color Theory Design Co., which was really exciting to have her on. I'm a member of her Flowering Minds education program. And so she has this whole thing where she has these online videos where you can learn about different floral techniques or, you know, watch her arrange different types of arrangements. She has beautiful style. And so it was great to talk to her and kind of hear more about that. So we will hear from florists this season. And then also from my friend Dorsey, who works at Blossom in Portland. It's a landscape company and she does landscape design. So we're going to talk a little bit about how you can like create different rooms in your backyard, kind of like a more functional yard or space that you can enjoy. And I thought that was really useful because I've been trying to work on our like kind of mess of a backyard and just make it something that is better for, I don't know, me and my husband to enjoy, and then also a space that I can grow flowers but have it not be like the efficient cut flower, you know, beds where I have like rows and rows of flowers that I can cut, but more like fun and perennial and things that are going to come back even better in future years. So that was cool to talk to her. And two other guests that I'm going to have on are friends of mine, Jess from Curly Girl Gardens and Kristen from Neighborhood Flower Co. It was really special to talk to both of them because I love hearing about other growers' small businesses and the types of products that they sell, where they sell to. So I hope you'll tune in for the rest of this season and, you know, listen into these various topics. My idea for the podcast is really just to hear from people in the flower-related industry, whether it's about like what they grow, what their business is like, you know, tips that they might have for growing or designing, things like that. It's just really like a forum to talk about flowers and to kind of extend the types of conversations that I love to have with people when I get to ask them about, you know, what they do. And it's really special to me. So anyway, I am looking for guests for season two, and my email address is Sarah, S-A-R-A-H, at growgirlseattle.com. That's my business that I have. And so if you have ideas for guests or you want to be a guest, feel free to shoot me an email and I'd love to consider that and chat with you for the next season. So I have a couple guests lined up and I just have to get those interviews recorded, but would love to have the second season be a little bit more interactive where I can hear from you guys about what you like, what you don't like, who you want to hear from. And, you know, maybe you don't like my singing and you would rather not have a song of the week, or maybe you love it. You know, maybe you want to have Vikram back. I would love some feedback because I kind of feel like I'm just like throwing my heart out into the ether, and I've gotten some really nice comments and messages and stuff, but I don't know how things are hitting. So I'd love to hear what you think, what you want to hear about, and yeah, shoot me an email, sarah@growgirlseattle.com. All right, we're going to take a brief musical interlude and we'll be back with today's interview. Today, I'm so excited to welcome back Margaret from Ballard Urban Flowers. Thanks for joining us, Margaret.
I'm excited to be back. Thanks for having me.
Could you start, just in case anyone didn't listen to your seed starting episode earlier this season, could you just kind of tell us a little bit about your business and what you do?
Yeah, I grow on several urban, essentially front yards in Ballard in northern Seattle. I've always loved the challenge of how do you grow beauty in a really small space? And with really tight succession plans and really thoughtful layout, you can grow a ton of beautiful flowers to share in your community just in where an old unused lawn used to be.
That's pretty cool. And you fit a lot in. I'm very impressed. So if people want to hear a little bit more about your garden setup, they can go back and listen to the other episode. But can you just tell us some of the flowers that you're growing?
Yeah, my main season is in the summer, just with such a small amount of space. I don't have as much room for things like roses or peonies or whatnot. So I primarily focus on the summer. So dahlias are a big component, zinnias, focusing on kind of specialty colors within those, celosia. Absolutely love snapdragons. And I'm always on the lookout for just really fun textural elements. I love dried grains with kind of their different colored awnings. I love little twinkly bits that just can make a bouquet go from a collection of flowers to something just really special.
Well, people should go check out your bouquets. They're gorgeous. And I can speak from experience that your flowers last forever. So today I wanted to talk to you a little bit about dahlias, which we both grow in an urban environment. And I wanted to just first have you start. I know there's a lot of dahlia mania going on right now, but what are some of the reasons that you grow dahlias?
Oh my goodness. Dahlias are the it flower right now. And I don't think they're going to stop being the it flower for a while. I mean, it makes sense. It's like a collector thing. You think of like snapdragons. Well, you just buy a packet of seeds, you plant it in the ground. And, but with dahlias, there are all these very unique varieties and it's based on a tuber that you buy and the allure of being able to multiply your stock. So I can totally see why everyone loves, absolutely cherishes dahlias. In my case, I think that they are a core part of how I can provide summer blooms in a really limited amount of space. Because if I think of, say, snapdragons, right? Put a succession of snapdragons in the ground. Off of those plants, I will harvest flowers for a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks, and then they're done.
Yeah.
And then I've got to put a new plant in its place and wait a couple months. Even like a quick succession of sunflowers takes a couple months to get up and going again. Dahlias, I put them in the ground, and once they get started blooming, I have months upon months out of that same small space until the frost takes them out. When you're growing in a really small space, they're a good bang for your buck. Now, they're not the only thing I grow, because I love having a variety of different textures and colors and forms in a bouquet, but they are really the backbone of what I do, because they're the most effective use of space for me, just based on our climate, because I can get blooms from mid-June all the way. You know, the plants do slow down when it gets a little bit colder in the fall, but I'll get blooms until frost, which is usually in November.
Wow. And so how many flowers would you say, just like, I know it's different for each plant, but how many flowers do you think you can on average get from one dahlia tuber over the course of the season, I guess?
Oh my goodness. many. I mean, it also depends. So some varieties are known for being high producing, just large numbers of stems. And when I think in terms of what I want out of this, what my goal is, not just to have beautiful plants in the yard, but is to be able to harvest from them and sell them. So I want varieties that produce a lot of stems. And usually I can get, I would say that I'm getting 5 or 6 stems a week per plant.
Wow, that's incredible.
So that adds up. And those are on the high production ones. And then each variety is different. Some will take pauses in the summer. I mean, just like all of us, they get tired, right? Yeah. They'll put their first flush out. They'll take a little bit of a break. They'll come back again. And then some are just workhorses. And I'm looking at Blizzard. Blizzard is amazing white flower. And it just keeps churning them out all summer long.
Good. Well, I'm glad I invested. I got 3 Blizzard this year on your recommendation. So
you will not be disappointed.
Well, what are some of the traits that you look for when you are deciding which dahlias that you're going to put into your limited space?
It is so hard every year to edit down. And I find that's because there's so many incredible varieties out there. And I always get allured with new color palettes. And I've learned that I have to be very strict with the types of color palettes that I do, because it's not only the dahlias that I have to worry about, but all of the supporting flowers that I go with it. So if I put on a new color palette, say I go really deep into pinks or corals, okay, well, do I have snapdragons and zinnias that match that color palette so I can actually make a bouquet? Well, if I don't, then I have to devote even more space to those. So I find that I focus a lot on oranges, not like the neon. I mean, a couple of neon oranges because they're beautiful in the fall, not neon, but a more vibrant orange, but more muted peaches. That's really where I've focused a lot of energy on developing a good list of dahlias. Whites, I do some purples. I've expanded in my pinks, but I tend to avoid reds and corals, anything that's too bright. I find that it doesn't match with the rest of them. So I have to be really restricted that way, which is so hard. And there are amazing lavender ones out there. I have just been dying to get this one lavender variety called, I think it's called Last Dance, or no, Last Chance. And every year I'm like, don't do it. Don't do it. You don't have space to expand to that color palette, and you don't have the space to do all the supporting flowers. So I had to be very restricted that way, but there's so many beautiful ones out there. So what I focus on, I have a set of criteria when I bring a new dahlia in. It needs to be a strong producer with long stems. There are beautiful ones out there that are great in the garden setting, but if they aren't going to perform for me to have enough flowers for bouquets, then they might be beautiful in my garden, but they're not going to be the one that I'm going to be cultivating for the business. I love really unique forms. So anything that has a really crisp line to the petals, I find that the shadows play well with that, and it creates almost like a different dimension to the flower. So really crisp kind of triangular petals that curve back are just absolutely beautiful. So I tend to go for balls and some formal decoratives as the style. These are the ones that I find have the longest vase life. And there are beautiful ones that are dinner plates. And for what I do, and I primarily sell to flower stand and bouquet subscription, and then also to florists, I need the longest vase life possible. So I don't do any of the extremely frilly ones. I might try them from time to time, but they need to have a long vase life for me to continue growing them long-term.
That makes sense. And so when you go on to these like Dahlia pages, you can obviously see photos of them. So you get an idea of what they're going to look like and what color they're going to be. But what other ways are you researching them to find out, like, will they have a long stem, or are you buying only from certain breeders that are kind of breeding for that trait? Or how do you sort of like suss that out if you've never grown that Dahlia before?
Yeah, it is so hard in the fall when you see all the sales open up and the winter and the spring and you see a new color pattern, you get really excited about it. But I'll step back and I'll look back through. I take screenshots just throughout the year of different other growers that I follow on social media and see what are they growing? What are they celebrating? What are they excited about? And what do they say works really well with its vase life? And I'll always go back to it and say, okay, this variety looks really beautiful. Are other people also growing it? And do they also say it's beautiful? And what was the goal? Is say it's a new introduction. What was the goal of the breeder? Because for so long, dahlias were produced for exhibitions, right? Like you grew it to have this perfect stem to bring to a Dahlia Society show so that you could potentially win an award for how you had grown it, but it needs to look beautiful in that day only, but it may not have a long vase life. It may not hold up well in a retail setting or transportation to a florist. And so there are new breeders coming online now, which I'm so excited about, that are focused specifically on the cut flower industry. So how can they make sure it's not only a pretty bloom, but they're only putting things out to market that are that can hold up in a production setting. So those ones I get really excited about, because not only is it beautiful, but it's actually going to make sense for the business. The tricky thing is soil and your climate can change the color of things. And I have learned this the hard way. I have to be very careful with yellows because of the type of soil that I have in the pH and just our climate and the temperature. Most yellows turn neon for me.
Oh.
So me, which is just like, oh no.
You get this beautiful yellow that you're excited about, like a buttercream or something like that. And then it turns neon.
Oh, and it's most definitely not buttercream. Yeah. Those growers that are out on the East Coast have a different climate than us. And they can pull off these beautiful shades of colors. And then I get the same tuber over here. And it is the same tuber. It's not like there was a mix up. And the tone of the colors is very different. And so I also look to see, is there a grower locally that's selling it? What are their photos? And I look at those. I found a couple of things, like Formby Crest is a beautiful yellow that performs great in our climate. It is not neon. And thank goodness I found that one. I finally have a yellow, but I do have to be really careful. There's Cozy Town released the Baby Cakes Dahlia last season, and I was able to get a hold of it. And all season long, she was posting photos, and she's back out east, and she was posting photos of this very soft pink. And mine was this very deep, rich pink all season long. I mean, it was gorgeous and I absolutely loved it, but it didn't look like the one she had. And so Leanne and I would exchange notes about, well, I guess in Seattle, it looks a little bit different. We've got cooler summers and just the soil is a little bit different. And that's always a challenge for sellers and for breeders is, they can show you what it looks like in their soil. But until it's been out in the world for a little while, it takes a while to create a collection of the different colors that it might be in different climates. So that's the other test is that's why it's so good to buy from a local breeder or local grower as well, is that you have a much better idea what the color is going to be for your climate.
Similar conditions. Yeah, that happened with some of my oranges in my garden. Well, things that were sort of on the border between orange and pink definitely veer more orange in my garden. So I've been working on that too, and just trying this year to get all my dahlias better soil health, which is something that I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, because you mentioned that soil health can influence the color, but it can also influence the health of the plant. And so what are some of the things that you've noticed in your garden relating to soil health, and what are you doing this year?
Soil health is so important. Last season, I planted dahlias in two places. So some were in my yard, and I've been gardening my yard for quite a while now. And so the soil is really rich. It's got a strong microorganism community in there that partner with the plants to give them the nutrients they need. So planted there, and then also planted, I had expanded, my neighbors allowed me to take out their lawn and grow flowers there, which is an incredible gift and opportunity. And it had been lawn for decades until we flipped it and built the beds in there. And the soil was in a very different state. So same plants planted in my yard, and then across the street, the dahlias across the street looked great, and then crashed mid-August and never really recovered. We're talking stunted growth, powdery mildew, and I couldn't harvest off of them other than blizzard. Blizzard just kept chugging away. I mean, I knew that was a flower that I wanted to have.
Okay, people should take one thing is go get Blizzard.
Go get Blizzard. The petal form is gorgeous, and it is incredibly productive, and just is a very solid white to have in your mix. So anyway, across the street, all of a sudden I had been counting on all of those blooms, and I couldn't harvest anything else from them. The plants were just done. They didn't have the nutrient base to pull from. There wasn't enough. I mean, the soil underneath didn't have a high organic content. So compost, essentially. I'd put a bunch of compost down. It needed more. But also what it was missing was the microorganism community under there. And so when plants photosynthesize, you know, they're creating carbohydrates to feed themselves, but actually a good amount of it goes down into the soil, and they excrete that out into for access to that microorganism community in exchange. It's like a barter system. Those microorganisms, and I mean, worms would be a very giant example of those. There's lots of much smaller, and you talk about fungal communities as well. And they pull deep into the ground and pull up all of these nutrients that are already in the ground and in the soil and help bring that up to the plant. And the plant is much more resilient that way. So if it senses a stressor, like an insect is attacking it, it can reach down to that community and say, I need a certain something to help me respond better to this insect attack. So when you've got very vibrant underground community, your plants are stronger. And that was on full display for me last year when I could look at my own yard and see dahlias that were 6 feet tall. And then across the street, where I was just so devastated to lose dozens and dozens of dahlia plants. I mean, I was able to pull tubers from them and restart them again this year, but it was the missed opportunity of those blooms that I didn't get. So soil health is key. If you can really strengthen your soil, and that is what I did this winter, is I put down a lot more compost. I'm working to incorporate more of Korean natural farming and Jadam methods of kind of fermented brews that essentially boost the microorganism community in the soil. And there's a lot of great stuff, resources out there, like the Living Soil Handbook and Jenny Love's Regenerative Flower Farming Network. And lots of great resources out there that I can recommend if you want to learn more about that. But just, I don't grow flowers, I grow soil. And good soil is what grows the flowers. So dahlias do best when you've got good soil.
And grows more and more beautiful flowers too, because you can get them over a longer season, more blooms if the plant is healthy. So that's really good advice. And so I know we've talked about a lot before that, you know, this isn't dahlia's like natural habitat here in Seattle. So <No. laughs> where, if you could tell us a little bit about like where dahlia's, you know, natural environment would be, and then how you might sort of recreate that wherever you live.
Like everyone out there, I'm always searching for what is the trick? What's the tip? How do you grow good dahlias? And it really comes down to, well, where are you? Where's your growing space? And then what does the plant need? And for me, my aha moment with dahlias was really thinking back to, well, where did they originate from? Where are they indigenous to? And that gives me a sense of the soil and the temperature and the climate culture that they would be, that they thrive in. And then how do we mimic it up here? So they're from originally the highlands of Mexico and Central America. So in a frost-free climate, not scorchingly hot. Dahlias do tend to shut down if things get really too hot in the summer, you know, and steady supply of moisture. Well, when we grow dahlias for production, we're doing some things that are really different to the plant, right? Which is why they're It's so hard to figure out how to crack the code. We're literally pulling them out of the ground at the end of the season, dividing them up, figuring out how to store them. Well, okay, where would tubers naturally be? Under the ground. But we may have frost that would kill them otherwise. But in Mexico or in the highlands of Central America, they would be nestled in the ground in a warm, moist environment that's, you know, free draining. So they're not sitting in water. So when we think of propagating dahlias, you're taking a tuber that's lifted out of the ground, you're sticking it back into the soil. And, you know, what's the soil temperature when you put in it? You might be taking cuttings from it. All of these things wouldn't necessarily be what the plant would naturally do on its own back where it's indigenous to. So you want to think about how can you mimic the things that it needs to thrive. So it needs some consistent level of moisture, but not too wet. Out here in Seattle, we tend to get tubers rotting because it's so wet and our soil can't drain necessarily as rapidly as it needs. When you are buying a tuber and it comes in the mail, you want to make sure that it has enough moisture around it that it's mimicking the soil. So I tend to wake up each of my tubers before I stick them in the ground, or I do a lot of potting up of tubers ahead of time. And in that case, it's just make sure the moisture level is right and the temperature level is right to try and mimic what their natural growing conditions would be in. So a 80 degree room might be a little too hot for them to sprout versus what they would normally experience in like the springtime where they'd be from, where it's like a little bit closer to upper 60s, lower 70s, something like that.
So you mentioned you're kind of waking up your tubers. And is that something that you're doing like when they arrive in the mail or ones that you've had stored? What's kind of like your process for doing that?
I mean, quick overview and anatomy of a tuber. So you've got the main tuber bottom, which just has the carbohydrate store to grow the plant. And then each one needs to have a solid neck connecting up to the crown, and on the crown needs to have an eye sprout. So if you're lacking one of those pieces, so good chunk of tuber, or at least enough of a tuber, a unbroken neck, a crown at the top, and then the eye sprout that's active, you won't have a living plant. So if you get a tuber in the mail and you try and sprout it out and no sprout ever appears, it's not a viable tuber. It's not ever going to grow a plant. So it needs all of those different pieces. So the eye sprout, I like to know before I put something outside that it's viable. And so I will pre-sprout it. Usually a lot of times when they come in the mail, they are already in a bag that with slightly moistened, maybe peat moss or vermiculite or something like that. I just keep them in the bag. Or if they don't come in something like that, I'll stick them in a little Tupperware with a semi, not wet, but like slightly moist holding material. And then just check on them. Sometimes it takes a week. Sometimes I've been sitting on a Nicholas tuber for a month now, and it still hasn't sprouted, but that one is notoriously long, takes a long time to sprout. So I'm not worried. It'll eventually sprout. I can see the eye. I know it's there. But usually within a couple of weeks, the sprouts will start to emerge. And then I know that it's viable. I like to get a jump start on the season. And so I pot up all of my dahlias ahead of time. And that way I'm essentially putting a plant out in the ground when I finally plant it, rather than just a tuber that needs to wake up underground. I just find with our wet springs and cooler springs, I just get a better result and an earlier start to my season this way. But it only works because I've got, you know, low tunnels over all the planting beds, so I can keep them warm. I can protect from frost. They like soil that's at least 55 degrees. So I need to make sure those tunnels are over the top to trap heat in there. So there's a lot of extra effort that goes into starting an early season, but I like to pot everything up when it comes to me and grow it out in my house. Obviously houses are not the same as where they would naturally be growing. We've got central heating, and so my soil dries out faster. So that has been an interesting trick for me, is to figure out what degree of moisture do I need? How much do I want water versus not water? They always say, don't water until you see a sprout. Well, when you're growing inside a centrally heated house, that's drying out, you do have to do a little bit of watering. And it's a fine balance. I've definitely rotted tubers by not striking that balance right.
So once you have your potted up plants to go in the ground, or for people that are just planting their tuber straight in the ground, like how do you plan where you're going to put each one? Do you group them by color, by height? And I know some people might just be putting them like in their garden, and so this might not apply to them, but for growing for cut flowers, what's your setup for like how far you space them and how you decide which order they're going to go into?
You can go very artistic with this. Maybe to a fault. I think in terms of like, it feels like flower growing is very driven by Instagram and photos. And so it can look gorgeous to have a full color rainbow of how you lay out the order. But the truth in the matter is not all your dahlias are going to sprout at the same time. So if you're just putting tubers out, that's one thing. But if you've got a varying size of plants going out, I have found that you want to put like sized, I guess, like aged plants together. Otherwise they shade out the little ones. So last year I lost some dahlias and I tried to infill with some smaller plants. They got shaded out and I never saw bloom off of them. So what I do is I usually have probably two waves of planting. So one where I've saved the tubers myself, or I got early shipments in from growers. And those ones are all about the same size when I do my planting. And I usually plant, last year it was late April. The plants are really big this year. I think I have to do earlier and just throw some extra frost cloth over them to keep them warm. Cause I'm running out of space to store them.
Yeah. They take up a lot of room.
Why did you grow so big? Slow down. I'm not ready for you yet.
They really take off when they get going too. And then your whole house is like a greenhouse inside.
Yeah, which is lovely. And I need to boot them outside. So I put the first wave out together and I do put it in color order because I find it's actually a lot easier for harvesting. So if I know that I've got a florist order for oranges, I can just go to the orange section and just very quickly inventory what I've got. Now, I also know the size my dahlias get. And so some of them are massive, like Cozy Town Baby Cakes got huge for me last year. I'm not going to put that in front of like White Netty. That's like a very short petite one, or like Blizzard in front of White Netty, because it's going to get shaded out. So I do look at the height and so make sure that I'm not shading anything. So there's a little variation that way, but I do one round of planting where all the plants are about the same age essentially. And then I'll do another round where these are the tubers that, I mean, I'm still getting tubers in the mail right now, and we're beginning of April, and it could be into late April before I get all of them. And so those plants are going to be much, much smaller. And in reality, I could just put them out as tubers. By the time the eyes are sprouted, it might be the right temperature outside to actually just plant them direct rather than do this whole process of potting up and putting under grow lights and all of that.
And so for people who live in different climates and they have a little bit of a different schedule in terms of when their tubers are going to go outside, what are kind of like the conditions that people should look for when it's the right time to plant their tuber in the ground?
Yeah, so they do best. So if you're talking about just putting a tuber in the ground and not a plant, so it needs to have enough warmth in the soil to sprout, you want your soil temperature, not ambient air, but soil temperature, to be at least 55 degrees. So you can artificially raise that by covering it, a growing area, putting black landscape fabric down ahead of time or something like that. But that soil needs to be warm enough for them to sprout. So here in Seattle, mid-April, late April, somewhere in there. The other thing is frost will kill them back. If it's not a deep hard frost, it probably isn't going to kill the tuber per se. You just are set back where that sprout, whatever green is above ground, gets killed back, and you have to wait until a new sprout comes up out of the ground. So you've lost some time. So you do want to make sure that you wait until danger frost is gone, or you've got, if there's like a small little dip in temperature that comes along, you've got some form of protection, like a frost cloth you can put over the top, so you're not delaying your plants coming up. So you want to stay on the safer side. In Seattle specifically, we get so much spring rain, and it's on the cooler side, that tubers can rot out by, they just aren't sprouting yet. Essentially, tubers don't need to be excessively watered until they're actively growing, because it's not just about, everyone says, wait until the green tip is above the soil and then water. What they're really meaning is what you can't see underground is the root structure has emerged. So they don't need water. They have enough moisture within that tuber to do that initial sprout. They don't need actually water until the roots start going down. then you can start watering it. And if you water them too much when it's just the tuber, no roots, that's when you rot out the tuber. Okay, well, you plant, put a tuber in the ground outside, and then you have like a crazy rainstorm, you know, multiple days of rain coming. Is if your soil doesn't drain really well, though, that tuber hasn't yet developed up that root system. And so you might have it sitting in water and it might rot out. So waiting until it's a little bit warmer so that the sprouting happens faster, I think that's part of the key. Now, other areas of the country, we have a long spring. Other areas are like cold, 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 and then immediately switch to the hot summer. So it's a totally different thing. So you want to talk to your local Dahlia Society, talk to other growers in your area and see, well, what do they do? And that's how I've learned a lot about the timing for me, is just talking and listening to other growers that have more experience than me on when do they put them outside, and then trial and error. You know, if there's a variety that you don't care as much about, just stick it out now and see like, well, what does it do?
Right. It might work. And then you might have blooms at some point. So that's good. So just to recap, kind of look at what the last frost date is for your area and maybe add a little bit of a buffer just to be safe. And then looking for about 55 degree temperature. And then if you live in an area that's really rainy, make sure it's in well draining soil, at least until you can get better root systems started. Yeah. So that's super helpful. Yeah.
That's part of why I can get the plants out earlier, like I do, because I'm putting them out as plants. So they have an established root system. So I'm less worried about the tubers rotting out, because it's a plant. It's not a tuber. I mean, it's the two things combined, right? Like the tuber has already sprouted. You've got a full plant. So I feel more comfortable putting them out, even if it's wet outside, when they've got a fully established root system, because they can handle that at that point. It has become its own plant. It does not need the tuber per se as vitally as when it was just a tuber without the root system behind it.
That makes sense. And so one topic that I am kind of dreading talking about with you, just because it gives me anxiety, is Dahlia virus. It's really hard.
Oh, it gives me anxiety too.
So have you ever seen Dahlia virus on your plants?
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Oh, last season was brutal. My first season growing dahlias, I didn't know that I had virus. I suspect one plant had it. But it wasn't on my radar. I had read through all the groups, look for crown gall, look for leaf gall. So I was on, you know, and that's a bacterial infection. So I've been looking and looking and looking. I was like, I'm clear, I'm good. Wasn't on my radar to think about virus. The next season, which was last season, so I've only been growing dahlias a couple of years now. I went ahead with all my sprouting and my growing or whatnot. And then I was like, what's this weird line on all my dahlia leaves? Ugh. Like, not, you know, everything, like leaves looking a little bit different can be a lot of things. It can be nutrient deficiencies. It can be a lot of different things, but this was like scary, bright yellow. The veins of the leaves turned that color, like deep, deep, deep difference in color between the dark of the green of the leaf. And then the veining was this bright, bright yellow, stunted growth. So it was like a couple different things just didn't look right. Started doing a little bit of research, and yeah, that would be, I mean, I didn't get it formally tested, but I decided to cull the plants anyway, because it was enough things were pointing in the direction that it was indeed virus. And I was worried it was going to spread, and it was probably some infected stock from a grower. Cause most of the things I got from that grower ended up getting the virus in a very like pronounced way. And then there were some that came from a wide variety of different growers. And I think that it was me in my pinching of the dahlias. I just used my finger. Mm-hmm. So my fingernail went from a diseased one, and I got a little bit of the plant tissue with the virus in it under my fingernail, boop, 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 went down the line.
Oh,
and so I spread it to my other ones. And potentially there was one, I caught on a whim the very first growing season. I had a blank space in the garden. I was like, I'm just going to go buy a dahlia. And so I just went and got one of like the pre-potted up ones, you know, a local garden center. And I probably, like, looking back at photos now, I think it had virus. A lot of that stuff is imported. Like, buy locally, know your grower.
Yes. More,
they may still have occasionally, you know, virus happens. But you have a much better chance that it's going to be disease free if you know your grower and it's local. But man, I think I brought in a little bit that way. And so I ended up having to pull out 30 or 40 plants, which is,
oh my god,
take to the heart, brutal, because most of them were new varieties that I had spent all fall and winter, you know, like the sales we have to get on and like buy at just the right time to actually get them. All these new varieties I've been so excited about, whoop, had to pull them up out of the ground and toss them. Because I was worried they were going to spread to the whole collection. I'd lose them all.
Yeah. And that's one thing. I mean, both of us, I think we make our kind of which dahlias we're buying. We take the pictures of those and kind of put them together so we can see colors and styles and forms of the dahlias. And so when like a third, or how much of your total stock would 30 or 40 plants have been? Was that like a third of your total stock last year?
Yeah, it was about a third.
Wow. Yeah. To lose like a third of that. And maybe, you know, ones that you were super excited about, especially because tubers range anywhere from $8 to some of the ones that we've been getting, the specialty ones are like $32. So
it was an expensive learning experiment for me. And I was extremely vigilant after that. Everything was being monitored across the summer. If anything was suspect, I was pulling it out. I did do a bit more research into making sure it wasn't a nutrient deficiency. And so just pulled the ones that really felt like it was indeed virus. I wish that there was an easier at-home test around the virus. It's not out, to my knowledge, it's not out to market yet. I'm hoping that at some point there is something like that. The ones I have seen are virus specific, and there's multiple different viruses the dahlias can get, and they're extremely expensive. So if you are doing this on a very large scale and you really, you know, it's part of it, your business model, you can do it. But for a small operation like me, it doesn't make sense to do so. So I had to just go off of what does it look like? Well, it didn't look good. And a couple had the tomato one, which is like a bullseye. I was like, oh,
this is definitely virus. Pulling that out.
You do not have like a bright yellow bullseye appear on leaves. That is naturally fine.
It is hard though, because you came by right after this had just been happening to you, and you walked through my plants with me and our friend Jess, and we saw some that had like potential, but it also could have been nutrient deficiencies. And so it's really hard to know whether to pull it or not. And that's sort of why I think I mentioned I have a lot of anxiety about this, is you could be pulling out like something that you spent a lot of money and time and space pre-potting or pre, you know, getting ready to put into the ground, and then have to pull it. And then also you have an empty space there, and it's kind of hard to find something that's going to fit with those same plants. So do you have any like advice or tips? I mean, you mentioned the bullseye and some of the things to look for, but how do you decide if it's nutrient deficiency and you're going to give it a little more time, or, you know, if you're going to pull it out right then?
I think the first thing is to step back and breathe.
Okay. I need that advice.
So when I see something, I'm like, oh, okay. And not make a snap decision over it. So in my case, because I was almost 99.9% certain that I had a virus infestation essentially in my stock. And so I then would look at the ones that were suspect in a different light, because I already knew that I had virus or very, very, very likely had virus. And it's not just like the deepening, like I have a couple of plants right now that have like slightly yellowing on the veins, but they're healthy otherwise. And it could very well just be that like they're just missing a little bit of a nutrient they need because they're being grown in pots right now versus in the ground. So they're not getting maybe that full spectrum. So I'm keeping an eye, but I'm not jumping on removing it. And so if you know that you have a history of virus, or you see very strong signs and you see multiple signs stacked up, so like the deepening of yellow veins and stunted growth, okay, or stunted growth and disformed leaves, like multiple things piled up are usually a stronger indicator of virus versus maybe just seeing one of those signs. And you can take a moment to maybe try and do some research about, well, what are some nutrient deficiencies that might also cause this look, and try and remedy it that way. And if it doesn't respond, the thing that I most relied on last season for continued control was cleaning of all of my cutting material or my cutting equipment. So when I went out into the field and I was cutting, I actually would sterilize my clippers between each plant because I knew that I had the potential of still having virus out there. And the last thing I wanted is to transmit it between plants. I wanted to be able to not have it spread any further. So I would use a 10% bleach solution that I would dip my clippers into and then wash off with soap and water. So I would carry a bucket full of water that my blooms would go into, a bucket of bleach water and a bucket of soapy water out to the field. And yes, it took a really long time. And I know that growers on a much bigger scale just have to cut their losses and maybe sterilize at the end of each row or like their other approaches or sterilize between varieties. But in my case, I just was so worried about losing even more after losing over a third of my plants. I didn't want to lose more. So I was doing it in between each individual plant. And I think that helped me feel like I wasn't at least my own part spreading it. Aphids and other insects can also spread it because literally the virus just lives in living tissue. It doesn't live in dead tissue. So it doesn't travel season to season in the ground as long as you're not leaving a living part of the plant in the ground like a tuber. But the sap is primarily what you'd see the transmission in the summer. So you make a cut on a plant, you go to the next plant, there's a little bit of the sap on your clippers, then you're spreading it because it's open wound to open wound. If it's open wound to just a leaf that's closed, less likely to have transmission, but the clippers are really the main way, or like an insect that goes and takes a bite out of one and moves on and take a bite out of another. So it can be nerve-wracking thinking about virus and what it might do. But there are a lot of great resources out there. The American Dahlia Society, your local Dahlia Society can be great places to bounce ideas off of experienced growers about what's normal, what's not normal. Mm-hmm. And I would take the first step of just observing things before pulling them.
And take a breath. That was
take good a breath. Yeah. And it might be, I know a lot of growers, you know, this was interesting. It's about the impact of climate on plants. Last season here in Seattle, we had this crazy heat wave in June. And so if you put your dahlia tuber in the ground rather than just as a tuber, rather than a plant like I did, you've got this, the first sprouts are coming up and there are these little plants out right at this heat wave came. And dahlia growers in the region were like, what is wrong with my dahlias? They look diseased. And it was because this brand new fresh green growth that normally would be getting cooler. I mean, June is like January around here. It's cold. It's, you know, it's not summer yet. We don't get summer until after 4th of July. And so you've got like 60 degree temperatures and some overcast skies normally. And then we got like, I think it was 80 or it was upper 70s, which is, I mean, for Seattle is hot. And the plants really, really suffered. And everyone thought it's virus. It's virus. And people were wondering, do I pull? Do I not? And it was just the plants freaking out because the climate had been so different than what they needed at that time. And it took them a while to get readjusted. So I've heard experienced growers talk about whether or not to reevaluate their field. And then they stepped back, they paused, and they said, let's just observe.
Yep. It might have been the heat wave or some other environmental factor. Well, before I want to close the episode with some of our like things that we're excited about growing this season. But before we do that, do you have any other tips or learning lessons that you found from growing dahlias?
I would say have fun with it and experiment. Every year I'm experimenting with some new way of taking a cutting or starting a tuber, and then do the amount of work that is right for you. I love the science behind how to grow these and the challenge. And so I love like starting them inside as plants and seeing the different life stages that way and being able to have an earlier start in the season. That might not be the right thing for you. I mean, my living room or my dining room is taken up with a big giant grow light station. That might not be the thing that works for you. And I grow on a scale. I've got this year planned 120 dahlias, which compared to some growers is like a tiny, tiny, tiny amount. I can baby my plants because it's not that many plants. Yeah. So I can make it work. And it's something I'm passionate about learning to do. You will still get amazing blooms if you just stick them, the tubers in the ground at the right time in your, you know, like late spring and still have amazing, amazing blooms. So don't feel like you need to find the system that works right for you. But I love how it's a continual learning process and that each year I'm trying new tricks. And then of course, something new comes up, like slugs or just a difference in climate for the summer that keeps me on my toes learning. So I love doing that.
It's always something. Yeah. Great. Well, why don't we close off with, if you could pick, why don't we say three that we're both really excited growing this year? And that's kind of small. So if you want to add two in on your turn, you can, but let's go back and forth a little bit. So do you want to start with one of the ones that you're pretty excited about growing this year?
I am really excited to grow Rosendale peach again.
Okay.
So I got this one from Camille's Flowers. She's up kind of near the Canadian border in Northern Washington. And it took a little while to bloom last year, but the form was impeccable. And the like long, strong stems, the petal form was beautiful. And just this perfect color of soft peachy orange that I absolutely loved. So I'm really excited to grow it again. And I have had the hardest time in the world getting cuttings from this because I didn't get a lot of tubers and I just want more plants. And I still haven't had a cutting take from it. So I'm crossing fingers that I get more than just one plant this year. But I'm so excited to see that one again, because it was, I love crisp form of the petals and it checked all the boxes. I'm really excited to see that one again this year.
Yay. All right. My first one is going to be Crichton honey. I don't know how to say that one, but I got this tuber from Sunny Meadows and I was able to take a few cuttings off it. So I'm excited. Hopefully I have a couple plants, but it's kind of like this golden flower. And it's interesting because I find with a lot of dahlias, if you look up a dahlia variety, there's like all these different photos and many of them have different colors because especially with dahlias, people can photograph and different lighting, or it just grows differently in their soil, like we talked about. But in that variety, I've seen a lot of variation with some like peachy pink coming into the yellow and, or the gold color. So I'm excited to just see like the variation on that plant and how it turns out. I think it'll be a little bit of a surprise. All right. What's your next one?
I love what Christine's doing at Santa Cruz Dahlias. And yes, I ordered quite a few of her new varieties. And I'm just really excited to see the growth habit. And just how the blooms perform and the color up here. Obviously she's growing down in California. And so how are they doing up here? I did her Kelty Rose last year. And a lot of people talked about some of her other varieties last summer. Kelty Rose is incredible. Highly recommend growing it. I'm really excited. Did a bunch of cuttings and I should have more plants this year. It is this perfect soft pink that's just hard to describe, but like a medium toned pink, not like a baby pink, and like a dusty rose color. And the form is beautiful and the plants were super vigorous. So I'm really excited to see her other varieties because I know she really prioritizes not only beautiful blooms, but that the plant habit is really strong. And so I'm excited to see how her other ones perform and are they similar plant habit and how do they work for cut flower production? So very excited about the ones I got.
What are the ones that you got from her this year? Do you remember a few off the top of your head?
I got Blood Orange because I love oranges. And I actually got to see it. So Triple Wren Farm up north of here, they do a dahlia festival in the fall. And they have been trialing some of the Santa Cruz dahlia varieties. So they had a little patch. So I was actually able to see the blooms grown in Washington ahead of time, which was really cool. Christine just releases all of her dahlias through Stonehouse Dahlias as cuttings. But it was really nice to be able to see up at Triple Wren. Well, what does a plant look like? So I got to see Blood Orange and really liked it there. Boho Peach, Bella Luna, I'm blanking, I've a couple other ones as well, but Boho Peach was beautiful to see in person, so I'm very excited about that one.
Well, we'll keep this as a Santa Cruz Dahlias round, because for my turn, I'll also do mine. Last year, I grew Mocha Maya, which was so beautiful, and it is one of the tubers that I lost, unfortunately, over the winter, and I think it was my favorite dahlia from last year. It's sort of like everyone's obsessed with Cafe au lait. It doesn't look like Cafe au lait, but it has some similar color hints in it, but it's a much smaller dahlia. So it's not like, I found with Cafe au Lait when I work with them, it's like 7 inches. So it just like, it's like the whole front of your arrangement and it's just this flat shelf. And I don't really like the style of that. I love using them if you're making like a huge bouquet and you can stick a bunch in and it's really tall. But if it's just a small arrangement, it kind of takes up everything. So the Mocha Maya really like fit in with my design aesthetic. But this year I also got blood orange. And then another one that I'm excited about, it's not my normal color palette, but KA's Cafe Mauve is like this really beautiful kind of light pink on the front, or maybe some yellowing in there as well. And then on the backside is like a true pink on the back, or I guess a mauve, you might say. So I'm excited to see how that one turns out because it's a little bit different than my normal style, but I think it fits in pretty well. And then I missed getting the Mocha Maya, but I did get Mocha Joe. So I'm excited to have that kind of sort of coffee cream color somewhere in the in the garden this year.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I got Mocha Joe last year and it was one of the ones I lost to virus.
Oh,
no. I saw a couple blooms before I had to pull it and they're very stunning.
Good. Okay, good. Well, we'll look forward to that. And then do you have a final? It's so hard to choose, especially if you're growing 120, yeah. But do you have one more that you want to mention?
I decided to expand my color palette slightly this year. So I'm excited to do a little bit more of the kind of rusty, deeper oranges. I did one last year called Obsidian and I lost it. I didn't get any tubers that survived, which is really unfortunate. But it was this beautiful deep orange color. And so this year I decided to get Brown Sugar, which is a widely available one as kind of a deeper orange. And then like kind of a brownish. So it's like perfect for fall coloring. And then I got a new one called Copper Boy and it's just come over from England. And I'm very excited to try that one out and see how it looks in relation to Brown Sugar. And I'm hoping that that gives me a little bit more diversity of color as we head into the fall to pair with like the Mahogany Splendor Hibiscus and some of those just really beautiful sunflowers that come on in the fall that are like the deeper purple and orange tones. So very, very excited about that.
That sounds beautiful. Okay. My third one is going to be kind of like my wild card. So I ordered two Night Silence dahlias and they're sort of, I haven't seen many of these before. I just was looking on a website and it just really stood out to me. So I didn't have a lot of data points. So I don't know what the stem length is going to be like or what the plant habit is going to be like, but I'm excited to give it a try. It's kind of like pretty dark in the center. I kind of steer away from red. It's not really in my color palette. Sometimes I'll use it as like a pop, but it's not my favorite. Night Silence isn't red, but it has a little bit of like undertone of red and it's got kind of a dark center and like a frilly form. So I'm excited to see what that turns out like and just have one that's a little bit, you know, different and exciting to try growing. So
ooh, fun. We should do a little experiment where you take a cut, you bring one of those and I've got some like deep purples that I'm trying out this year and yes. We should do like a little color layout and see like, how do they all, which one's darker than the other and how do they all fit together? Like Ivanetti and Joey Morella and Nadal. And I've got a couple that I'm excited about. And I'm always trying to see, well, how do they all fit together? Right. You look at photos and the deep purples are impossible to photograph. So well, how do they actually look in person? How are they going to fit in a bouquet? So that'd be fun to see that one alongside the others and see how they all look together.
Yeah. And I mentioned on like the intro episode that you and me and Jess took the Floret workshop at the same time and we would like get together to have our little monthly meetups. And just for anyone that's listening, I'm really lucky because Jess lives like 3 blocks away from me and Margaret lives like 10 blocks north of me. So it's pretty cool. We can all kind of like walk to each other's houses. And especially in the growing season when we're super busy, it's nice that we're so close that we can just swing by. And I buy flowers from you. I hope to be buying a lot this year. If you have them for sale, I will be buying them. And so basically I'm just excited that we live close by and that will give us an opportunity to kind of like peek into each other's gardens as the season goes. So
it's definitely fun. It's a way to you don't have to buy every dahlia in the world. You just have to have a group of people around you that buy every dahlia in the world. And then you can just get to compare and enjoy all of them without taking over your whole yard in the process.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for joining to chat about dahlias today. And maybe when we do a later season, we can do some of the other side of dahlias where we talk about like storing them and what we do to kind of close down our gardens in the winter. But we want to keep it on the hopeful side because we're on the early end of or the pre-blooming end of dahlia season. So we're going to keep the convo on that today, but more to come in the future, hopefully. So thanks so much for joining us, Margaret, and I'll talk to you soon, I'm sure.
It was great to talk to Margaret as always, and we'll have more dahlia related topics on later seasons of Flower Friends. I just wanted to get it started with like the timing. We're starting to plant out dahlias here, and so I thought it would be a great time to release this interview and just get a little bit into the start of dahlias, but definitely more to come. So I forgot to do the flower facts on last week's episode, so I owe you one. So we'll do two and we'll keep them short and dahlia related for this episode. So the first one is that when my dahlia plants are between about 10 to 12 inches tall, I will pinch them on the main stem. So I'll just go down a set of leaves or two and make a cut. And basically that will cause the plant itself to branch out, be a bit bushier, have more stems that flowers can go grow from so that you get more flowers from each plant. And then also it makes it so that the flower stems themselves are thinner and easier to work with in arrangements, because if you don't pinch them, the middle stem can grow like broomstick size and get really, really thick. And then, you know, if you're trying to put that in a vase, it kind of takes up the whole vase. So pinching is really great for the plants. But as we talked about dahlia virus earlier in the episode, just be sure that you are cleaning your clippers in between unless you're really certain that the plant that you have doesn't have virus. So that's my first one. The second one is that I think it was like 2 months ago that I saw this. It kind of blew up on Instagram. So you guys might have already seen it. But if not, there's this account. It's called Serenade Farm Tamarine Mountain. So a little bit of a long Instagram handle there. But if you go to their page, and I'll also repost this, they have this incredible seedling in their breeding patch that's just really beautiful. It's like this kind of, I would say, creamy, light pink, maybe a little coffee color to the base of the flower. And then inside each petal that's that color, there's like a light purple swirl inside. It's just this really cool form. I've never seen anything like it. I don't know if there's already something like this that exists, but for me, it was brand new to see something. And I don't know if they'll take this seedling to the point where they're going to sell it for tubers. I'm sure they need to do a lot of like testing on, you know, how sturdy the stems are, how the plant grows, things like that. But just for the looks alone, it's absolutely gorgeous. So I hope it gets to the point where we can all access it in the future. Okay, and your song of the week this week is Wildflowers by Dolly Parton, one of my all-time favorite singers and one of my all-time favorite songs. So good. So she also has a version with Linda Ronstadt and Emmylou Harris, which I recommend checking out. Hope you'll give those a listen while you're doing your flowery things this week. And if I can ask a favor, it would mean the world to me if you could go on to wherever you listen to this podcast and rate it or review it. You know, if you can leave a comment, that would be really helpful. It just helps get the podcast out there for other people to listen to. And if you have any friends that might be interested in the topics that we cover or the guests that come on the show, it would be awesome if you could just share the podcast with them. So thank you so much for listening and have a great week. Take care. The hills were alive with wildflowers, and I was as wild, even wilder than they.